The news the following day is dominated by the minister's bleak prognosis. Messages of support pour in from allies and opposition alike, as well as conjecture as to who will replace him. One name that keeps cropping up is Walter Kolles. Walter? Well, why not? Aren't you supposed to have an ideology to be a politician, like believe in something? He believes in money. More importantly, money believes in him. As CEO of a major multinational, Walter has the financial acumen to steer the nation through the present economic cataract, or such is the hope. A BOT client has head of finance. I would like the sound of that, Jocelyn muses. Plenty more sweet consultancy work. Walter's a fucking nutcase, Ish says. Put him in charge and he'll turn the whole country into a rendition site and sell it to the CIA. Gotta make the money somewhere, Jocelyn says, shrugging. It seems that the revelation of his illness has pushed the minister past some point of no return. In his press conferences now, he looks not merely sick, but for the first time defeated. The fundamentals are sound, he keeps saying, the same blanket denial to every question in the same leaden, exhausted tone. His face is suddenly gaunt, wasted. I can't work out quite what it reminds me of. Then I look out and see the grey hulk of the unfinished Royal Irish headquarters, rain lashing in through the empty sockets of the windows. The international news is even worse. The Germans are castigating the Greeks. The Greeks are burning German cars. In Texas, the blackened husk of the self-immolated congressman has made a speech from his hospital bed, declaring that he might not have any skin left, but he can still shoot a gun. At least that's what his press officer says, he says. The croaking is to my ears unintelligible. Hordes of elderly people storm the streets of El Paso, his hometown, waving Confederate flags and flaming torches. In Oran, the Caliph's new fleet of British-made bombers, bought in an oil-for-weapons deal brokered by the ex-prime minister, raise what is being called a rebel stronghold, though it looks, in the before photos, like a village harboring nothing more dangerous than goats. The whole world is becoming angrier and angrier, but not me. Paul is coming over tomorrow night to lay out his initial plans, and already it seems I can feel Ariadne's warmth stealing into my life, like the first rays of light creeping into a room as outside the sun wheels into view. On the day of the dinner, however, he calls to tell me that there's a problem. Remember that volleyball tryout Katia went to the other night? Well, she made the team. Oh, I say neutrally. That's good. Yeah, the only thing is, he's got a game tonight, so I have to babysit Remington. Oh, I say again. You know, make him his food and so on. I realize he's angling for something. I would be happy to prepare something for Remington, too. Why, Claude, that's very kind of you, Paul says with painfully false surprise. But I don't want to impose on you. No imposition, I don't very often have the chance to cook for others. Fantastic. Listen, though, Igor's probably going to come over, too. Igor? Yeah, but don't worry about him. He'll eat anything except fish. He hates fish and chicken. But don't go to any trouble. He tells me he will see me at 7, then 10 minutes later calls again to say that it might be closer to 7:30, and also that Igor doesn't eat beef, but does eat veal. I put the phone down, not sure what to do. A part of me wants to tell him about the perfume in the stairwell, the clothes stuffed in the bag. But what business is it of mine? Anyway, it's not impossible that there really is a volleyball game, isn't it? They arrive at 7:45. Paul apologizes again for the change in plan. This whole cleaners volleyball league is all a bit out of the blue. Of course, I say. And how are you, Remington? Remington's got a joke, haven't you, Remington? Paul prompts him. Will you tell me your joke? I ask, bending down to the boy.
What do you call a man who's been attacked by a cat?
Remington mumbles. I don't know. What do you call a man who's been attacked by a cat? Remington sways shyly back and forth a moment, then goes to hide himself behind his father's leg. It's funnier when he does the punchline. Paul says. Not to worry, I say, and then to Remington. Do you like hamburgers? He nods solemnly, then tugs his father's trouser and whispers in his ear. "Oh, right, Claude. Was wondering if it would be possible to watch a little Rainbow Mystery Epic?" A minute later, Remington is installed on the sofa, the serenity of his attention in almost exactly inverse proportion to the blizzard of lightning flashes, screeching robo-animals and epileptic scene shifts issuing from the TV screen. "Jeez, Claude, where's all your stuff?" Paul says, gazing around the apartment at the abundance of white surfaces. "I left most of my things in Paris." In fact, it had been a relief to get away from them, the artworks, antiques, juicers and coffee makers, the shelves of unread books, unwatched DVDs, unlistened to compact discs, all carefully arranged in alphabetical order, everything that had promised to be the final piece of the jigsaw and then wasn't. Now, apart from one or two objets, I just download everything. It sits unseen and forgotten on my hard drive, an alternative life I can own instead of living or ever needing to think about. "These your parents?" Paul flashes a photograph at me. "Yes," I say. "I have been putting the family pictures on computer. How do you say, making an archive?" "Your father looks like a pretty serious individual," he says, leafing through a stack of old Polaroids. "Look at those arms. What did he do?" "He was a blacksmith." "You're joking." "Does it seem funny?" I strip the foil away from the neck of the bottle he has bought. "No, no, it's just..." He looks down at the picture again. "I mean, talk about your dying art. Can't be many of those left." "No, there are not many," I say. "So what was it like?" "What was what like?" "Being the son of a blacksmith." I shrug. "It was just his job. I didn't pay so much attention. I was busy with my studies." "Of course. You were his greatest creation." "I don't think he saw it that way." "Old father, old artificer," he says obscurely, gazing at the picture. "Maybe there's a book in you after all." "That's his story, not mine," I say, handing him a glass of wine, delicately taking the photographs with the same movement and replacing them on the shelf. "So, you have had a chance to think of some ideas?" "I sure have. But I'd rather wait till the big guy gets here." "About that," I say, "why are we involving Igor, exactly?" "Well, he could really use the money," Paul says. "I mean, he's having a hard time getting by at the moment. By the way, I told him to invoice you separately. Is that okay?" "He's going to put it down as a termite infestation." "I don't intend to be rude," I say, going to the hob and rattling pots to cover up any trace of anger in my voice. "But I am not sure that Igor has something to contribute to this project." "I fully understand what you're saying. You don't need to worry. Igor's an extra pair of hands, that's all. Also, he's the one who knows how to use all the equipment." "Equipment?" "The surveillance equipment. He's got a real knack for it. Back in the communist days, he did quite a bit of work in that field." "Say what you like about the Soviets. In terms of surveillance, those guys were the gold standard." I stare at him in mystification, but before I can ask for clarification, the intercom sounds. "That must be him," Paul says. With great reluctance, I go to the speaker.
"Hello? Hello?"
shouts Igor's voice.
"Push the door," I tell him.
"Hello? Hello? Can you hear? Igor calling!"
Eventually, he manages to get in. I have not seen him since his plot with Paul was exposed, and it seems to me a guilty look crosses his face as I open the door, but then he may have many other things to be guilty about. His furtive appearance is accentuated tonight by a large, clinking bag and a beige rain mac of the kind favoured by perverts in films. He enters the apartment, shoulders hunched, head bowed, legs taking long, loping strides as though stealing down an alleyway. "There you are," Paul greets him. "You remember Claude?" Igor brandishes his stained teeth at me in the kind of duplicitous smile one might employ when secretly installing surveillance equipment in the home of a friend in the former Soviet Union. You are very welcome, I say coldly. Make yourself at home, Igor, Bodhi encourages. There's wine on the counter and some really nice cheese. Hey, Remington, look who's here. Say hello to your Uncle Igor.
Hello, little Remington.
Igor crooks his knees and spreads his arms out wide like a degenerate bear. On the couch, Remington starts to cry. Igor, unhugged, creaks to his feet again.
Well, he says to me.
I do not reply. He hovers uneasily between couch and kitchen. I sense that he wants to say something about the bank deception, but he just shifts from foot to foot as if suppressing a bowel movement. Then he asks me where the bathroom is, and I realize with horror that he is suppressing a bowel movement. I hurriedly point him in the right direction.
The flush in this house, she is good?
He asks urgently. What? I say, but he doesn't expand, instead hastening away.
That Igor,
Bull says fondly, shaking his head.
I could tell you some stories.
There is no need, I say, and remove myself to the safety of the cooker. Not long after, the bathroom door opens and Igor saunters back into the room with an unconcealed air of unburdenment.
Very nice facility. Toilet roll soft like velvet. I feel it should be wiping its ass with me.
He stretches, then sets himself down on the couch. Remington edges in the opposite direction.
Why you bring the boy, eh?
Igor says. Paul explains that Klitsia has gone to play volleyball. Igor makes a tsk noise and wags his finger.
You are playing a dangerous game, my friend, he says. Sports can give these women crazy notions as well as unsafe muscle mass.
She's never been a sporty type, Paul concurs, but she's been so damn angry lately. I'm hoping this will help her relax.
In old days of Victoria, no sport for women, Igor reflects. Unless incest. If incest is Olympic sport, Victorian women win every gold medal.
I told you before, Igor, I don't like you spouting all that Soviet BS about Iktovia. There was no more incest there than anywhere else.
Ugh, you are right. Incest is everywhere. And it is just the political correctness gone mad that peoples must say they do not incest when everyone is incesting all the time.
Dad, what's incest?
Dinner is served, I say quickly, even though it is not quite. The television is silenced and Remington reluctantly seats himself at the table. It feels odd to hope that a 4-year-old boy will have a civilizing effect on the conversation. Sorry, Claude, I should explain. Igor's from Transvolga, and when the Iktovians seceded, they took most of the carpet manufacturing business with them.
Ha!
Booms Igor, pounding his meaty hand on the table.
We do not want them or their shitty carpets. What is Iktovia? Only the shithole city of Karakel and a few crappy fields where the fey menfolk practice their gymnastics and the women walk their dogs that are like little furry gays.
As you can see, it's still something of a sore point.
They are short bastards too, these Iktovians,
Igor adds judiciously.
Bastards!
Remington repeats.
That's right, little one.
Igor chuckles, reaching over to stroke the boy's cheek. This looks fantastic, Claude, Paul says as I deliver the plates.
Escalope de veau cordon bleu, I say. It is the characteristic French dish.
I'll tell you what, if you ever get as far as cooking a meal for Ariadne, you'll be home free.
So,
I say, seating myself and ignoring Remington's mistrustful stare from under the bun of his burger.
Your plan? Okay, well, without blowing my own trumpet, I think I've had a breakthrough. What happened was, I looked up that play you mentioned, Cyrano de Bergerac, and it turns out to have all these great ideas. What happens is, there's this guy who likes this girl, but he's shy, so he gets this other guy. I am familiar with the story. Right, so what I'm thinking was, we do Cyrano of our own, like
I give you the lines and you say them to Ariadne. This is your breakthrough? You don't like it? It just sounds very familiar to what I proposed to you already. Well, superficially maybe, but see, with the surveillance equipment, I can not only give you the lines, but I can also monitor her response to... What's up, buddy? Now Remington needs the toilet. Apologizing, Paul goes to escort him, leaving me alone at the table with Igor, who fixes me with a silent, ghoulish smile. I try to think of something to say, but the smile is too disturbing, so instead I get up from the table on the pretext of fetching something from the fridge, only for Igor to rise too and stroll around the living room, appraising my sparse possessions with a nakedly avaricious eye. Nice place, he says, picking up a conch shell from the dresser. Very nice. Thank you, I reply, cracking open the oven. Nice, expensive objects, he muses, moving closer. They are pay you many monies at this bank, eh? I pretend I haven't heard him and hunker down, bustling about meaninglessly with the racks. I think I will go over here and cut some more cheese, Igor declares, and I am just wondering why he felt the need to announce this when my arm is twisted behind my back and a blade pressed to my throat. Don't move, dog, Igor hisses, his rancid breath in my nostrils like an encyclopedia of stenches.
What are you doing?
I hear Paul cry in horror from behind him.
Quick, tie his hands,
Igor commands, and then to me,
talk, pig!
Talk about what? I am genuinely at a loss.
The safe, where is it?
What safe? What the hell are you doing?
Paul shouts.
I'm trying to find out where the safe is.
Jesus, Igor, would you let it go? There is no safe. I explained that to you a month ago.
But you say we come here for the plan,
Igor says. He sounds confused, though he keeps the blade to my throat.
The new plan, Igor, the new plan. I told you we're helping Claude to get with the waitress, remember?
Oh, Igor says. He lays the knife down on the counter. There is what may be safely described as an awkward silence.
Why was Igor killing Claude?
Remington whispers to his father. It was a joke, Paul tells him, and then, inspired, says, Right, Igor, it was a practical joke. Igor hoists his lips to an unconvincing grin.
Look, not even sharp.
He waggles the cheese knife at me with what is meant to be a comical expression.
No way to cut a man's throat with this, only child's throat.
Ha! Laughs Paul.
Ha!
Laughs Igor.
Ha!
Remington joins in. Now all three of them are laughing. I think it might be better if Igor left now, I say.
No more veal?
Igor's eyes well with disappointment. Paul shakes his head. Igor turns to me for clemency. With a gasp of disgust, I look away.
May I use bathroom once more before I go?
He asks humbly. You may, I reply, still without looking at him. Igor trudges to the bathroom. The awkward silence prevails again.
Dad, was Uncle Igor ever a person?
Remington asks. The toilet flushes and Igor shambles sheepishly back into the room. His rain mac is on again and has been buttoned right up to the throat. With difficulty, he stoops and picks up his bag. At the door, he turns.
No hard feelings,
he says and lifts his hand in farewell. Four fresh toilet rolls and a veal cutlet tumble from under his coat. The four of us look at them on the ground.
Okay,
Igor says and lets himself out. I make coffee, and Remington returns to the television. So, all's well that ends well, Paul says.
From now on, I prefer if it is just you and me working together,
I tell him.
What are you saying?
I am saying no more Igor.
What? Why? Because he came at you with a cheese knife.
Paul attempts to work up a plausible tone of incredulity.
We're trying to make art here, Claude. It's not going to be like working in a bank. Some days you'll feel inspired, some days you won't. Some days Igor will come at you with a cheese knife, some days he won't. That's the creative process.
I confine myself to pouring the coffee. Look, I don't want to pull rank, but I would respectfully remind you that I'm the artist here. You commissioned me to direct your life artistically, and now I must respectfully ask you to let me do my job. I am not stopping you from doing your job. I would love to see any evidence at all of you doing your job. He gasps, then there is a silence. I glance over my shoulder, but he is not looking at me. Instead, he seems to be staring at something on the far side of the room.
Claude, what is that?
He says. What is what?
That on the table there.
That is a novel by Bimal Banerjee called The Clowns of Sorrow.
I can see that. What I'm asking is, what is doing in your house?
His tone is that of a wronged lover who has discovered traces of a rival in his mistress's boudoir.
I'm reading it,
I say, feeling apologetic all of a sudden without knowing quite why.
It's about circuses,
I add, thinking this might endear the book to him.
I know that, Claude. I know because that fucker completely ripped me off.
He is genuinely angry. It surprises me, especially as Banerjee's book has only very superficial similarities to his own.
Are you kidding? They're both about circuses. They both have clowns in the title, for God's sake.
Yes, but your novel is a bittersweet romance about a clown and a starchy office worker, for which the circus provides an occasional backdrop. The Clowns of Sorrow is... I turn to the back of the book for assistance here. Both an allegory for the poverty and wonder of the India of the early 21st century, and a brilliantly constructed arena in which language itself is set to perform breathtaking feats of daring and imagination. Paul listens to this with his head bowed and his hands on his hips like a truculent footballer receiving a telling off from the referee.
You don't get it, Claude, he says. This is a writer thing. I spent years putting together the first serious clown novel. Breaking down that wall, opening people up to the idea of a book about that world, and then he sweeps in and takes all the glory.
It is true that Banerjee's novel received praise and prizes that Paul's did not. However, both books came out at the same time, so it is difficult to see how the Indian could have deliberately stolen Paul's idea.
Exactly!
Paul pounds his fist into his palm.
How?
What I mean was, it seems more likely that he didn't steal your idea.
Oh, he stole it all right. He stole it. He sold it. And then he disappeared with a big pile of money before anyone got wise. And nobody's seen him since.
I am not sure whether I should tell him or not, but I suppose he will find out sooner or later.
Of course, he hasn't actually disappeared. He has a new book coming out.
What?
Paul goggles, flushes, goggles some more, until he looks rather like one of the creatures in Rainbow Mystery Epic. There was an interview only a few days ago, you didn't see it? I wake my laptop, and a moment later a caramel-skinned man with thinning hair and opalescent gold eyes is glowering out at me. Here we are. Mary Cutlass meets the award-winning novelist Bimal Banerjee.
Mary fucking Cutlass.
Paul says disgustedly.
That's the witch who slaughtered my book.
This is what she says. After 7 long years, the most brilliant writer of his generation has made his triumphant return. His new novel, Ararat Ratrap, is a work so masterful and compendious as to make everything else written in the last 20 years seem redundant.
Oh, Christ.
Paul says. With the exception, that is, of his own The Clowns of Sorrow, a groundbreaking imagining of India and the originator of the circus novel genre, subsequently much imitated.
What?
The new book, to whose scale and ambition only the work of Tolstoy comes close, presents both a pulverizing denunciation of the last 3,000 years of civilization and, in its inexorable beauty, its jocundity and its breadth of emotion,
a glimmer of hope. Jocundity? What the fuck is jocundity? I travelled to London. This woman writes like a fucking hernia, he expostulates. It's like they gave a fucking hernia a weekly column and told it to be as excruciating as possible until all of their readers have hernias too. I travelled to London last week. I read again, then stop. Well, that is not technically how hernias work. What? Paul says. Reading a hernia's column could not possibly give one a hernia. Perhaps a better likening might be to a virus which passes itself on to everyone it comes into contact with. Everyone's a critic, Paul declares to the ceiling. I travelled to London last week to meet the writer. Still a young man, Banerjee is exotically handsome, his leviathan intellect complemented by the looks of a Bollywood idol and a surprisingly powerful frame. I asked him how he had spent the past 7 years. Banerjee replies, writing, writing. People ask, how can it take 7 years to write a book? But to me, clock time, calendar time, is mere shadow play. The true marker of time is the creation of the novel. Each is, as it were, an oak ring in the tree trunk of my soul. Ah! Do you want me to keep going? He gurgles. I take it as a yes. Mary Cutlass. Ararat Ratrap takes as its starting point the Armenian genocide of 1915. Oh, so that's what got her so excited? Paul chimes in sardonically. Genocide! That's what she most loves to read about as she chomps on her croissant in her enormous fucking mansion in genocide-free Killini. Travelling forward in time to the present-day follies in the Middle East and backwards to the days of the Old Testament, all of it seen through the eyes of an uncommonly talented rat. Did you find it difficult to keep so many disparate strands together? Banerjee, no. That's all he says? No! Difficult is not the word. It was agonizing, heartbreaking. So many pages were lost because my tears made them illegible. Yet, even then, the novel continued to sing to me, and by listening closely, I found I could go on, just as by following his own song, Jeffot finds his way through the maze of history. Well, that's just meaningless, Paul says. That just doesn't make any sense. Mary Cutlass, Jeffot is the narrator and hero of the novel, a rat with a gift for rapping who becomes a hip-hop superstar. His voice is brilliantly achieved. Like Banerjee himself, Jeffot the Rat is charismatic yet unknowable, seductive and at the same time capable, one feels, of brutal force.
Jesus, just give him your knickers, why don't you?
Paul, who is now lying on the floor, exclaims,
Stop, Claude! I can't take any more of this!
This irrational hostility to a fellow author's success does not seem to me the attitude of a man who has turned his back on writing forever. I don't draw attention to it, just note ingenuously. According to this, the new book is published by Asterisk Press. Didn't they publish your book too? From the floor comes a short, ironic laugh. Sure it did. Dare say my old editor's behind this one. He always was a sucker for a fast-talking Indian with a novel about a singing rat. It says here that Banerjee is reading in Dublin next week. Do you want to go along? Why would I want to go to that? Maybe your editor will be there. You could catch up on old times. Paul is silent for a spell. Then he says in a quieter tone, No, I don't think that'll be such a good idea. You don't think he would be glad to see you? We had sort of a falling out. Artistic differences? Paul waves his hand vaguely. Who knows? It could have been anything. These publishing people are totally inscrutable. But anyway, he says, rolling up into a sitting position and rapping on the floor. Why are we even talking about this stuff? We've got work to do. The fact that the minister is not going to get better, unavoidably apparent every time he speaks on camera, seems to have woken the Irish from their state of denial regarding the future of the country. Now they have gone to the opposite extreme. Rumours are circulating that the government will soon run out of money and require an intervention.
What does that mean, intervention?
yet another panicked investor on the line. If Ireland can't pay its bills, the International Monetary Fund will step in as they have done in Greece. They'll take over all major political and economic decisions until the books are balanced again. Most of my clients, whose patriotism doesn't extend beyond the bounds of their golf club, quite like the sound of this, although if they turn on their televisions, they will see the IMF's current project is not running so smoothly. Another day, another riot in Athens. Thousands of citizens waving banners, hurling projectiles, collapsing to the ground in paroxysms as canisters of tear gas clatter around them. Though for me, this footage has taken on a romantic light, sparking fantasies of Ariadne and me running hand in hand from a masked and baton-wielding policeman.
Claude, you there?
Oh, yes. We don't think the IMF will need to come here. Ireland's not Greece. The ministers issued a robust denial. Seemed plausible. I have arranged to meet Paul at lunchtime for what he terms initial blocking. It's only when I let him into my apartment that I discover this means he wants me to go and talk to Ariadne. Now? Today? But we have not prepared. I remonstrate, following him into my bedroom, where he starts rifling through the wardrobe. Of course we've prepared. What were we doing last night? Jesus, Claude, how many black suits can one man own?
But we have not decided. I have not thought this through.
You don't need to think it through. That's why I'm here, remember? Paul turns, places his hands on my shoulders, and in a sonorous voice says,
Claude adjusted his stylish black suit in the mirror and smiled. The moment had come, and he was ready. Striding across the plaza, he threw open the door. The beautiful waitress started, then blushed. Taking her hand, he said,
The doorbell sounds.
That'll be Igor.
He said that'll... Oh, I say, and he bustles past me to the door and then... Wait, what's Igor doing here?
I ran into him last night in Private Desires. Come on up!
He shouts into the intercom.
Private Desires?
Yeah, it's a little lap dancing club on Capel Street.
What were you doing there?
I'm barred from Velvet Dreams, remember?
Don't look at me like that, Claude. Getting a lap dance helps me think.
You told me you had no money.
It's one of the cheaper places, mostly Romanians. Anyway, while I was there, I ran into Igor, who had also come there to think, and we agreed that we shouldn't let some silly misunderstanding get in the way of three of us working together.
Oh, I'm very glad you agreed that.
I promise he's got it all straight this time. He says. A moment later, Igor lurches in with his clinking bag. If he is feeling remorse or embarrassment about last night's events, he does not show it. Placing the bag on the coffee table, he unzips it and removes a series of grey objects, rather like bleak industrial flowers with long metallic stamens. I presume this is the surveillance equipment he talked about.
I asked you to do this because I wanted an artist's perspective, I tell Paul quietly. Not all this technology. This is the artist's perspective, Paul insists. It's the 21st century. Do you think writers are still running around with inkwells and quills? I think you are introducing a lot of unnecessary complication to give Igor something to do. Listen, maybe hiding behind a bush and whispering to your buddy worked for Cyrano in the 17th century, but if your girl, or for that matter any of the numerous security guards patrolling this place, catch sight of me hissing at you from under a table, it's not going to look good for either of us. Look, relax. This time out, I won't even speak. I just want to get a read on how the two of you interact. Think of it as a dry run.
Hold still, Igor says. He leans in to affix a bulky plastic earpiece. Paul says something unintelligible about radio signals. Igor responds with something opaque about transmitters and goes to tap on an antediluvian laptop.
Now remember, Paul says, clasping my shoulders. You're the hero. The whole story flows from you. Plot is just the illustration of character. Your character. You're the guy making it happen.
What am I going to say? It doesn't matter what you say. What matters is that she knows you're in charge. Women don't want some wishy-washy type who doesn't know his own mind. They want someone authoritative, manly,
who's not afraid to take control.
Are you sure an authoritative manly man is what Ariadne is looking for, given that she works in a feminist cooperative?
This feminism is an illusion, Igor rumbles. Only for depressed women who cannot find men and so must dress like lesbian and not the good kind of lesbian.
What Igor's saying is that a strong narrative appeals to everyone, no matter what their politics or persuasion. I'm not suggesting you go in there and hit her over the head with a club. Just be direct, confident. Own the scene.
I try to break into my new masterful persona by squinting manfully into the middle distance. Spots dance before my eyes.
Testing!
As he speaks, Igor's voice is fuzzily replicated in my earpiece.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. You are standing right beside me.
And I can hear you,
Paul confirms, cupping his hand around his own earpiece.
Okay, looks like we're ready to go.
Are you sure this thing is safe? I look dubiously at the ancient transmitter humming ominously on the balcony. Wouldn't it be easier just to use my Bluetooth?
Stop delaying, Paul says. Let's do this.
It must be said that as I make my way towards the cafe, I feel even less authoritative than usual. Out here, away from my models and spreadsheets, everything feels flimsy and contingent at the mercy of riptides and crosswinds, the random vicissitudes of nature.
How are you getting on there?
Paul's voice sounds in my ear. Fine, I say tightly.
That's great. Now you just keep cool. Remember, she's a character in your story. She's there for you, and will be with you too, every step of the way.
I turn and look back up at my balcony. Two figures wave down at me like mocking, malefic insects. What am I doing? Am I really going to go up to her and just start talking? It feels so crude and anachronistic. To my left, Transaction House croons to me seductively. I could go back to my desk, think this through properly. Maybe I could friend her online, find out her likes and dislikes, then in 6 months or so take the next step. It wouldn't be so dramatic in terms of the story, of course, but realistically.
Keep going, Claude.
The door of the Ark. I push it open, a ton weight. Happy diners gabbing to each other, the compressed bedlam of the coffee machine, the clank of cutlery on porcelain. Claude strode into the cafe. A voice, Paul's, my own, urges inside my head. My body feels alien, unwieldy, like an enormous robot that I am controlling with levers from a tiny chamber behind my eyes. As I lurch over the floor, all sound disappears, save for the industrial suck and whoosh of my breathing. I stumble through a forest of disconnected sense impressions until, like a beacon, Ariadne comes into view.
Hello, I say, but it comes out as a cough.
Hi, you,
she says, sliding a tress as rich and dark as coffee back behind her ear.
You want a table?
Yes, I say, though this is not what I want at all.
Already the narration is slipping out of my grip. Ariadne turns away to find me a seat, my cheeks flame with failure. It's all gone wrong. And then something distracts me.
New painting? Ariadne glances behind her to where the canvas hangs, I imagine illegally, on the fire door.
Yes, she says, lowering her green eyes bashfully. I just finished this weekend. I don't know if it works or what.
The painting features a series of warped helices knotted into each other like the DNA of some painfully malformed beast. It seems to protrude bulkily out of space itself.
I like it, I say. She laughs. This morning I heard a customer say it's like a zebra ate a whole load of fractals and got sick.
Both, they said the same thing about Van Gogh's sunflowers, I tell her.
Maybe,
she says, and she smiles. Not her usual waitress smile, it seems to me, but a deeper one, incorporating her whole being. A sudden wave of joy wells up in me. Here I am. This is
happening? How did I ever believe there was anything to fear? Ariadne is everything that is good, therefore only good things can come of this.
What's he called? I ask her.
Simulacrum 122.
I nod, tapping my nose thoughtfully. Out of nowhere, Paul's old idea has popped into my head that we bond over French philosophy. I wonder by any chance, are you familiar with... I begin. But at that moment there is a loud and painful buzzing in my ear, and then Paul's voice says...
Sorry, Claude, we lost the connection for a minute there. Are you in the cafe?
Yes, I say, trying to incorporate it into my question for Ariadne. Yes, I wondered if...
Okay, Claude, you're doing great. Now, are you ready to approach the subject?
I have always wondered, I repeat, trying to dig the earpiece out of my ear without calling attention to it, whether...
Wait, were you talking to her already? I cough deliberately. What was that? The connection's not that good here.
In the background, there is a popping sound, rather like a cork from a bottle.
What do you wonder?
Ariadne cocks her head and regards me bemusedly.
Just stay calm, Claude, and remember you're in charge. I'm going to go out on the balcony and see if I can fix this transmitter. Igor, you take over here for a second.
I wondered if you have ever read...
You have a great big dick.
A gravelly voice booms in my ear.
What?
I cannot stop myself blurting.
I didn't say anything.
Ariadne says, surprised.
You have biggest dick in world. You are striking her with your firmness.
Frantically, I pull at the earpiece, but it is wedged in tightly by its many points. Ariadne's beautiful forest green eyes cloud with concern.
Is everything all right? She says.
Your wood is so hard. You are the master.
Yes, yes, I tell her desperately, poking myself in the ear.
You are a lion between the sheets with your mighty length.
Please stop, I whisper.
Ariadne flinches ever so slightly.
I have to take an order, she decides. I come back to you.
I watch in agony as she hurries away. And at that moment it seems to me as if the whole cafe were merely a stage set after all, now collapsing and disintegrating before my very eyes. I reach after her, but before I can speak, a tremendous peal of static explodes in my ear. Just barely managing to suppress a scream, I turn and flee off stage, out of the theatre, into the null space of the outside. Paul is on the sofa in my living room, leafing through a magazine. He gets up when I come in.
There he is! There's the hero!
I do not give him the acknowledgement even of a snort of exasperation. Simply wrestle off my jacket, now soaked with rain, and throw it over the chair.
Igor had to leave, he says. He had a big exterminating gig, beetles.
I go into the kitchen area, where cupboard doors have been flung open, and the counter littered with tartines and cookie wrappers. What is this?
Oh yeah, we got hungry, so we made a snack.
And drank two bottles of Brouille, I say, finding the empties upended in a bin.
Yeah, we were thirsty also, it turned out.
How did you drink two bottles of wine in 20 minutes?
Well, we didn't drink both of them, we... My rug!
Yeah, see, that's most of bottle one there.
Clenching my jaw, I slam the cupboards shut, bundle up the debris, and wipe down the surfaces.
So I think we've made some important headway there, he says.
We made some important headway in the wrong direction.
He says ambiguously, and then,
look, I'll be perfectly honest with you, that didn't go 100% according to plan. I know it didn't go 100% according to plan, I say. I was very well placed to see it not going according to plan. Igor and I have been discussing it. he says. We both feel we may have taken a slightly wrong turn with the whole virile, masterful thing.
I stamp back into the living room, strew salt over the wine-stained rug. Maybe this whole idea was a wrong turn.
Don't say that. It was just a dry run, remember? And at least she knows who you are now, right? You've put yourself on the map, so to speak.
I have put myself on the map as a gibbering psychopath, I say.
You're blowing it out of proportion. Try and see it from the perspective of a novel. When do things ever work out the first time around? There have to be a few comic mishaps, right?
I replace the salt in the cupboard and dust my hands.
And anyway, there was a positive outcome.
Paul follows me back into the kitchen.
By listening to your conversation, I was able to work out something that you had in common, a shared love of modern art. That's something we can build on.
At the present moment, I don't want to build on anything. I am damp and hungry and desire nothing more than to go back to the office, putting this misconceived episode behind me. But Paul, no doubt, sensing a threat to his paycheck, keeps buzzing about me.
Look, if you're really feeling bad about it, we can start over.
How can we start over? This is reality, not typing. We can't just throw it in the bin.
Ariadne's not the only beautiful waitress in town. I've got a whole folder of them. Brunettes, blondes, redheads.
He falls silent, realizing he has said too much.
You have a folder full of waitresses?
Of course not. It's a figure of speech, that's all.
A figure of speech meaning what?
Nothing. Forget I said it.
Cogs begin to turn in my mind. Has the folder of waitresses, has it got something to do with all this bizarre surveillance equipment?
It's got nothing to do with anything,
he says impatiently. Can we just drop the subject?
Not if I'm being implicated in one of your scams.
It's not a scam. It's a totally legitimate business venture. And anyway, it's over. It's all in the past.
Oh, for God's sake. He rolls his eyes.
I'll tell you, all right? But you have to promise to keep it secret.
He glances over his shoulders, then bringing his hands together and pulling them apart as though unfurling an imaginary banner in the space over his head. He says,
hotwaitress.com. Hotwaitress.com? That's right. What is hotwaitress.com?
Right now, it isn't anything.
But it was a business venture, some internet thing?
He sighs.
Well, really, I should go back to the beginning, to 7 years ago when For Love of a Clown came out. I was young and naive. I had the usual fantasies. Everyone would stop what they were doing to read it. I'd become famous. I'd usher in a new era of peace and harmony, all that. Instead, it got one terrible review and then vanished without a trace. Look, the world is full of books. Moaning because no one wants to read yours is like complaining that you've been standing on the street corner with your dick out for an hour and nobody stopped to give you a blowjob. Still, it hurt me. And when I sat down and tried to start book number two, I had problems.
You were blocked?
I was blocked. I lost faith. Whatever the reason, nothing was happening. And meanwhile, of course, I'd got married. We'd taken out this huge mortgage to buy the apartment. Remington was on the way. I had no idea how I was going to pay for it all. I didn't tell Clitzia because I didn't want to worry her. I acted like the new book was coming along fine, and I kept heading out to work every morning. But at this stage, I wasn't even trying to write. I was just sitting in cafes looking out the window, wondering if everyone would be better off if I just jumped off a bridge.
Seriously?
Clearly you've never been in debt, Claude. After a while, it's all you can see, and it's a vicious circle, because the more I worried about it, the less chance there was that I'd ever come up with an idea for a book. Anyway, there I was, being depressed in various cafes. There were maybe 3 or 4 I'd go to at different times of the day. Over time, I got to know a few of the waitresses quite well. And if it was quiet, we'd have these long philosophical talks. They were young,
They had all the hopes and dreams, and though I couldn't exactly share their optimism, still, it was a way out of this endless, despairing conversation I was having with myself the rest of the time. In fact, I realized after a while that talking to the waitresses was actually the high point of my day, and then it hit me. That was the idea.
What, become a waiter?
No, no, I mean the relationship, waitress and customer.
I don't understand.
You think you're the first man to fall in love with a waitress, Claude? This is a growing phenomenon. And it's no mystery. Think about how we live now, packed off in our digital eyries. Yes, we have phones, we have email, but we might not speak to an actual flesh and blood person all day. And then we go to a cafe and suddenly in the midst of our fully networked isolation, there's a pretty girl who smiles at us and asks how we are. She's actually there, not just a face on a screen. And she's bringing us cake! Is it any wonder we form attachments?
That sounds plausible, I say gruffly, embarrassed at having my own situation so unsparingly detailed. But how does your business venture relate to it?
Okay, so you've developed these feelings, which are very natural and human. What happens when you sit down in your cafe or restaurant only to find that your favourite waitress isn't there? On the one hand, it doesn't sound like a big deal, but seeing her was literally the only thing you had to look forward to all day, and it actually feels pretty crushing. That's the kind of scenario Hot Waitresses is designed to eliminate. What we propose...
We?
This means you and... I ask with a sinking feeling. Me and Igor, what we proposed was a comprehensive guide to waitresses in cafes and restaurants all over the city. When they're on, when they're off, what sections they're working, their likes, dislikes, hobbies and pastimes, the latest gossip, as well as plenty of
Wait, I interject. Are you serious? This was a genuine business venture?
Well, yeah, he says, looking slightly offended. What's the problem?
There are so many problems, I have difficulty focusing on one.
How exactly would you find out all these personal details? The waitresses are just going to tell you? No, of course not. We'd have a dedicated data collection team deployed across the city, and we'd also repackage whatever the waitresses have uploaded themselves onto Facebook and so on.
The surveillance equipment. At last, the pieces fall into place. I feel a kind of deep and distressing pang within, a sort of moral headache.
Surely this can't be legal. It's an information service, that's all,
Paul says.
How can information be bad?
He sits down opposite me and leans earnestly over the table.
Imagine being able to tap into a resource like that for Ariadne. Think what a comfort that would be.
I wouldn't be comforted by the knowledge that countless others were out there stalking her online.
It's not stalking, Paul says.
It is, I say.
It's not.
It is practically the definition of stalking, I say.
Paul throws his hands in the air. It's the 21st century. People expect to be spied on. For a good-looking woman, it'd probably be more upsetting if she found she wasn't being spied on.
And your wife? What did she think about this business venture?
Oh, Clitia, he says impatiently.
Well, you told me before how much she hated being stared at by men in the club. What did she think of you keeping waitresses under surveillance?
Clitia's living in a fool's paradise. We have to eat, don't we? This is what people want now. They don't want novels. They want reality up close and personal.
Someone else's reality turned into entertainment.
You might not like it, but I tell you this. The response to Hot Waitress was the polar opposite to the response to Clown. We had investors queuing out the door, venture capital, private equity. We had a pre-launch party with an elephant.
An elephant!
So what happened? Why aren't you an internet millionaire? His face clouds. There were legal issues. You know how it goes. It got tied up in court. All our funding went on solicitor's fees.
Maybe for the best, I say. It could have been big. Loneliness is one of the few growth areas these days, and it's self-perpetuating, you know, because the more people pay to stop feeling lonely, the lonelier they tend to get.
Is that why you spend all your money on lap dances? I say. He purses his lips, lowers his eyes.
About that, he says, I'm going to need another advance.
Elephant runs amok at city centre event. A man was seriously injured last night and the ground floor of a Dublin hotel badly damaged when a hired elephant went on the rampage at the launch of a new internet dating service. Witnesses reported that the animal became enraged when an intern employed by the service attempted to dress it in a French maid costume. After trampling the man, who remains in hospital, the elephant overturned a number of tables in the reception room and charged at hotel guests. A zookeeper who arrived to sedate the animal described it as extremely agitated. The hotel manager, Mr. Wallace Willis, said that the event had been a fiasco at which basic safety had been thrown out the window. The company's director, Mr. Igor Struma, was not available for comment last night. Mr. Struma, described in the company's press release as an entrepreneur and bounty hunter, is wanted for questioning by authorities in Ukraine in connection with a robbery 5 years ago of a consignment of gynecological equipment. The company's president, Mr. Paul... What's you reading there, Claude?
Nothing, old news.
I saw you in the Ark.
Ish is chewing one of their homemade cookies. I was waving at you, but you didn't notice.
Ahem.
I swivel my chair away, busy myself shuffling documents.
You were talking to that waitress, and then you just took off like a streak of lightning. What happened? She catch you sneaking a peek down at top?
Hmm.
I stare at the screen and batter a random series of keys.
Like a streak of lightning.
She chuckles to herself, and then abruptly she stops.
Wait a second. Are you after her? Were you in there trying to chat her up?
I am not after anybody, I say irritably.
Is this what all this put my life in a book stuff is about?
She asks.
You're trying to get with Ariadne.
That's her name, isn't it, Ariadne?
I have no idea what you're talking about. Ariadne,
Ish repeats as if she's talking to herself, and then,
there's nothing to be embarrassed about, Claude. She's gorgeous. And she seems really cool, too, like a real free spirit type.
She notes this with a kind of sadness, as though she were watching Ariadne through the bars of a cage, though I wouldn't have thought she'd be the kind of girl you'd go for.
I'm not going for anyone. I snap. I experience a sudden, vehement wish for her to go away, because now I, too, can see the bars of the prison we are both incarcerated in, and my plan to escape seems foolhardy, laughable, like trying to dig your way out of a cell with a stirrer from a semi-skimmed latte.
Okay, whatever you say, she shrugs. Anyway, FYI, I have a date tomorrow night.
What are you telling me for?
No reason, she concedes and turns to her computer. This afternoon's episode has left me with serious doubts. Paul's intervention not only ruined the promising conversation with Ariadne, but I can't even console myself with the thought that it might have inspired him to write. Instead, it seems only to have reawoken memories of his harebrained business plan. Now I find myself torn. After today's demonstration, the wisest course of action is surely to cut my losses and abandon the project. At the same time, the more I find out about Paul's life, the more responsible I feel for him. Clitia's permanent fury now makes perfect sense. To marry an artist and find yourself chained instead to a professional lost cause whose efforts range from monetizing isolation to outright theft, isn't that a betrayal just as bad as the one that brought her here? When she signed up to work as a waitress and instead found herself contracted to a lap dancing club? Would it be any great surprise if she were looking for a way out? The rain comes down all day, and the next morning it is heavier still, turning the plaza into a dismal game of hopscotch. Figures in black shoes and trench coats leaping and splashing their way to shelter. At the zombie encampment, one of the tents has collapsed, and the undead scurry about with tape and buckets.
What's going to happen to them when Royal Irish gets shot down? Gary McCrum says, looking out the window. Will they all just leave?
I suppose.
Royal's the zombie bank, after all. Shame. Gary McCrum scratches his belly. They bring a bit of life to the place.
They're zombies, Gary.
You know what I mean.
The government has had a number of days to digest our report, but so far no action has been taken on Royal. The minister gives a brief statement this afternoon, but it's just the same threadbare phrases again. Royal is open for business, Ireland's fundamentals are sound, the IMF is not moving in. Behind him stands the little Portuguese man I saw in Rachel's office. He listens to the minister with lowered eyes, as if to a eulogy at a funeral.
Dark days for Ireland and Greece, and almost everybody else. But at BOT, the good times continue to roll. The market has responded positively to our quixotic takeover bid for Agron. The American bank's board of directors is reportedly receptive, as no doubt a beached whale would be receptive to being put back in the sea. An underwriter has been found, and Porter Blankley's old friend the Caliph has offered BOT a line of credit to the tune of several billion.
I still don't understand how this is supposed to work, Ish says. Agron is huge, we're small. If we borrow all this money to buy it, won't we be over-leveraged, like, massively?
This is, in fact, the whole point,
Jürgen says.
Potter's strategy is to distribute BOT's connections so widely across the global marketplace that we become systemically necessary, that is, too big to fail.
So they can't let us go down because then all of the people we borrowed from would be pulled down with us, Kevin glosses.
Ish still seems unconvinced. It sounds like putting on a suicide belt so that no one will bump into you on the subway.
That is quite a good comparison,
Jürgen agrees.
We are hoping BOT's high market standing will persuade the other subway riders to fund a particularly large and explosive suicide belt.
To ensure a quick turnaround, the deal will be done here in Dublin, where at least some of the extraordinarily complicated legal requirements can be brushed under the carpet. Corporate has been assigned extra offices in a building in the neighbouring block. Extra staff are being flown in from New York. On the 9th floor of Transaction House, meanwhile, where until a few months ago a property company had its offices, new doors with code locks are being hung, expensive new desks and chairs delivered, thrillingly white new whiteboards fitted to the walls. Details are scant as yet, but it is believed that the activity has to do with Porter's other prong, to take BOT deeper into the abstract, developing new financial instruments that will ensure profits no matter what is happening in the so-called real world. Howie's name is on the door of the corner office. He is taking Grisha with him, and a hand-picked team of junior analysts.
Those guys are going way out.
Kevin is seeking to alleviate the heartbreak of being passed over for the team by acting as a kind of ninth-floor John the Baptist, making sonorous prophecies about their work whenever the opportunity arises.
Way out.
But what are they actually doing?
Gary McCrum asks.
Kevin shakes his head.
All I know is there's some heavy fucking maths involved.
I heard Porter was giving them a hedge fund, Jocelyn Lockhart says.
I heard that too.
I heard it was a hedge fund, only more counterintuitive.
That's one thing you can count on.
Kevin slings his foot over his knee and swivels his chair.
Whatever it is, it'll be majorly counterintuitive.
And is Rachel involved in it too?
Rachel!
Kevin snorts. When we are alone, Ish tells me that Howie asked her to be on his team.
What? Why didn't you mention this before? What did you say?
She doesn't reply for a moment. A sudden blast of sun through the Venetian blind throws tiger stripes of shadow across her face. I said no.
No?
I'm confused. In our world, when an opportunity is presented, you take it.
I don't expect you to make the slog here forever. Howie is the growing star. He will bring you with him.
He shrugs, sips from her water bottle. Maybe I'm happy enough making the slog, she says. Anyway, it sounds like cobblers.
Did he tell you what they are doing?
Some sort of fund, all right. He said it was going to transform Western civilization, but it's Howie, Claude. He's a bullshit artist.
Porter doesn't think he's a bullshit artist. Kevin told me New York started bringing him in on strategy meetings. That bloke's never had a strategy in his life that didn't involve putting his dick up some poor unwitting bastard's asshole. Well, in their eyes, he is a genius.
Yeah,
Ish says disconsolately. Who knows, maybe he is. She turns back to her terminal. Bend over, world. Here comes another genius.